Right. Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and thanks for joining us for another of our virtual events. And we're really happy to have Taylor Moore back with us to discuss his brand new book, Ricochet. And sorry, we're running a few minutes late. Taylor has signed a batch of books for us, and I will go ahead and put a link in the comments field should you wish to purchase one. And also, if you have questions for Taylor, go ahead and put them in, and Barbara will summon me back on screen towards the end of the hour. Not towards the end of the hour. Well, anyway, in a little bit. And I'll be happy to ask any questions you might have. Barbara, over to you.
Thank you, Patrick. I mean, we're all confused because we started at an unusual time on the half hour. So anyway, here we are. It's great to have Taylor back. And we've been privileged to talk to Taylor about his first two novels, Downrange and Firestorm. I think Ricochet is a great title, and I really like the cover.
Thanks, Barbara. Appreciate it. You know, it's actually my second title. Flashpoint was my original title. And I, Don Bentley, remember, came up with Flashpoint just a few months ago. And I saw that, and I was like, Don, I was so mad at him. So I said, we're going to change it. But I actually ended up liking Ricochet better. I think it worked out better.
I think it's really actually great. And you'll have an interesting surprise when you read Don Bentley's new Jack Ryan book. Anyway, well, I'm not going to go further than that. So what we have are bad actors once again coming to Texas in Taylor's book. And why don't we talk a little bit about you for a moment before we talk about Garrett. So what's your background, kiddo? I know you're a sixth generation Texan, and actually I know the answer to this question, but what's your professional background before you took up writing thrillers?
Yeah, so the sort of crazy part of my background that I throw into the series is that I was former CIA. I was a CIA intelligence officer, and I did that for a number of years, and I got into defense contracting. So basically did the same kind of work, intelligence work for the military. And so did that for a while, and then got into the oil and gas business after that. And so there's a little bit from my, you know, growing up on a farm and ranch to the intel, to the military, to the oil and gas energy world. I throw a little bit of all of that into all of my books.
Well, you do. And since you're a sixth generation Texan, it makes sense that you would have bad guys come to Texas rather than sending Garrett out into the world to deal with them. And you're not alone in that. Texas is a big state. It's a border state. It has lots of resources. And also, it's not a surprising location for international intrigue. Anyway,
it's really not.
No, it's not. I know. It makes perfectly good sense. What did I just read? Oh, I know. Houston's going to be the 2028 Republican National Convention headquarters. So that actually be even more exciting than your international thrillers, the way things are going.
You never know, man. It's getting pretty wild out there.
So Patrick is reminding me that you're sitting here, maybe Comanche country. Is that true?
Yeah, this is where I'm in, definitely is Comanche country. And that's always, I put a little bit of that background into the books. One thing I really like to do, of course, this is a thriller, and it's got all those aspects, but I love the history of where I'm writing the book. The Texas High Plains is fascinating. And boy, that Comanche history, there's nothing more fascinating and terrifying and just really cool than that. So I always try to put a little bit of that, the Texas Rangers and all that kind of stuff, into the book. So as you're reading it, you're getting a little bit of history along with it.
Absolutely. Well, the Texas Rangers are certainly storied as well. They're both law enforcement officers, but I don't know, lots of other things as well. And the Comanches were one of the most warlike, were they not?
Yeah, what really inspired me, I read a book years ago called Empire of the Summer Moon. And if for people who haven't read it, it's a nonfiction book that almost reads like fiction. It's gritty and harsh. And it's, the Comanche were more the most warlike. And I'm almost hard pressed to believe that anybody on Earth could beat them on horseback in warfare. If you stack them against the Mongols or anyone else, they were just that good and that amazing, skilled warriors, and just hard to beat. So this is tough country where the book is set. And so again, I try to include some of that in there.
This is a sideline for me. Where are the Comanches today? Are there reservations in Texas, or where are they?
Well, yeah, a lot in Oklahoma is really where it's the, I guess that you would call their, I don't know if it's a necessarily reservation, but that's sort of their, you know, where their headquarters is and all that. And so I don't think there are that many left, to be honest. But Lawton is where they're sort of, they're headquartered. And so I included a little bit of that background in the book.
For some reason, I have a sneaking memory that many of them went to Mexico.
That could be the case. That could very well be the case, that some did go to Mexico.
I'm not sure. I know, you know, there's a load of Cherokee in Oklahoma because they were forced to walk there on the Trail of Tears from North Carolina. I mean, there was the whole colonial thing, whites against Native Americans, but then there were also Native Americans against Native Americans because they had lots of, tribal territorial disputes and so forth. Right. And I agree, Patrick is once again using the chat function to remind me how ferocious the Apaches were, which is so true. Right.
And they were the ones who mainly fled to Mexico. But I think some of the Comanches did too, right?
That's what I was gonna say. I would imagine to be the Apaches that have done that. But you know, they were really at war with Mexico for a number of years, and so, but they were closer to that. They were, you know, the Apaches. We think of them being over a lot of them in New Mexico. And honestly, you know, they were really, when we think about some of the last tribes to ever really, if you want to call it, be conquered or whatever. The Apache really never were. I mean, if you think about Geronimo, he was ultimately taken. And I think he spent the rest of his lives in prison in Florida. And he wanted to go back desperately to New Mexico, even as an old man. And I believe it was Theodore Roosevelt that wouldn't allow him to go back. And Roosevelt, I think, felt for him. He said, I just can't allow this because you don't understand how terrified people are to this day of you. And if you went back, they would think that, you know, bad things are going to happen. And so it's all, there's another book called Blood and Thunder, and it's all about more the, if you like command, or, you know, have you read that? About Kit Carson, but it's a lot of that history of the West and New Mexico. And I mean, it is absolutely positively fascinating. It's nonfiction that reads like fiction, honestly.
Well, that, and then I'll jump off, but the Llano Estacado.
Stick around, you know more about this than
I. Well, yeah. I'm just a nerd when it comes to this kind of history, but the Llano Estacado is such a forbidding environment, isn't it? I've never seen it in person, but.
It is absolutely, it's a death sentence. And if there's other, you know, for back in the old days when people would get lost out on the Llano, I mean, that was it for you. And there's another book, now that we're talking all these nonfiction books, and I've read a lot just because of the series that I'm writing, I'm blanking on the name, but it was all about the Dust Bowl. And you know, I think it was this book where they talked about, they would describe the High Plains as an ocean. And when we think of the ocean here in modern times, we think, oh, this beautiful ocean. They didn't mean it like that. They meant if you got lost out on the High Plains, it was like being on the ocean. You were going to die. There was nothing to save you. There was a lot of times no water, no resources, no nothing. And that was it for you. And so that Llano Estacado was just absolutely, and I live here. I live on the Llano. And again, we have civilization here, but you can look out on that flatness. And I always tell people when I get up like on the Cap Rock, I feel like you can see the curvature of the earth. You can see as far as you can see. You can't, but you can see so far. It just boggles the mind, the vastness and the emptiness. And sometimes it causes this loneliness. And again, if you read The Worst Hard Time, that was the book, the nonfiction book, I highly recommend. But it would talk about the loneliness that would settle in on the Llano and the High Plains. And it's just a cool, creepy, it's beautiful in its own way, but it's scary in its own way too.
It's fascinating history, you know, that in the Quanta Parker story, you know, with Cynthia Parker, the mom, you're talking about the Comanches being mostly decimated by disease, and you know, that's part of the reason that they took in so many white captive children, you know, was to bolster up the ranks and actually make them, have them join the tribe, if I'm not mistaken.
That history, again, I think for people, it's a complicated history, it's a sad history, but it's absolutely fascinating. And I guess what's some of the more fascinating parts too, if you talk about Quanah Parker, even Red Cloud, again, as we're talking books here, nonfiction, The Heart of Everything That Is about Red Cloud. It was amazing that you would have these very warlike, you know, these chiefs like Quanah and Red Cloud, and they would, I mean, who knows how many people they killed in their lifetime, but in the end, they ultimately sort of assimilated and their kids went to college and they sort of settled down and became landowners and business owners. And to me, it just boggles my mind how you can go from this sort of wild, you know, living, you know, on the range and just, and then just at some point they just changed and said, no, you know, that things have changed and we're going to go this way and this is how you make it in society. And they did. And,
and again, you have to but look at our current political landscape to think, yeah. Well, have we really gotten that far? You know what I mean?
Yeah, sometimes you look at things and you think, yeah, we probably, and nothing, I will put it this way, nothing surprises me anymore.
Yeah. All right, I'll go away. That was fun.
It's true that Texas and California could actually both exist as nations on their own. You know, I mean, they are each states, but the truth is they have, they're big enough, they have enough resources, whatever it is, that they could make it. You know, is, and Texas has always been a little bit that way, you know, not just the Lone Star State, but I always think of it as the Maverick State.
Yeah. Well, remember it was his own country at one point. And so,
And so that way quite often, but I mean, seriously, you know, I mean, because there was such a large component, you know, Hispanic component before, you know, it ever merged into the United States. Just like New Mexico. You know, my husband lived for 30 years in New Mexico, and he's always telling stories about, you know, people coming to Santa Fe and wanting to know where they could get pesos, or did they have to have, you know, a visa or a passport or whatever. I mean, they genuinely thought that New Mexico was still Mexico.
Mm-hmm. New Mexico has a very different feel to it. It honestly does. Louisiana does. There's two states that border Texas. And of course, everybody says that about Texas, but Louisiana feels like a different country. They got their own legal system. It's a whole different, you know, they have parishes and instead of counties. And, but New Mexico has that feel too. Of course, we're so close. That's where we go skiing in the wintertime. So we just drive over 3 or 4 hours and you're on the slopes. And, but it has that real, it has almost like a feel of a different country, and it's really unique and cool. And, the West is cool. You live in the West and you know that. It's just, I don't know. I really love the West, and probably that's why I center my books, on that subject.
I do too. I didn't grow up here. I grew up in Chicago, but Arizona, you know, is rapidly becoming more gentrified. People from California are fleeing over here. People came in the pandemic in unprecedented numbers. And, you know, it's a big state. Often when I'm talking to British authors, remind them that you can fit the entire British Isle into Arizona.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Even more so in Texas. But yeah. Anyway, there we are. So Kira Cole, having given you this background, Taylor has given you this background. So Kira Cole is in a bit of a reflection of you, isn't he?
I think a little bit. You know, the funny story that I've told before, but that, you know, Garrett Cole was a side character in the original novel that I got my agent with. I was writing more traditional sort of a Vince Flynn, Brad Thor, that kind of a spy novel. And the CIA guy was maybe a little bit more like me, or I don't know. I was writing what I knew. And so the DEA guy, this cowboy, I thought I was writing somebody a little bit different because we had different jobs, but a lot of me went into Garrett, and it became more comfortable for me. I think because Garrett looks a little bit different, or maybe had a different job, I could write more of myself into him without feeling like I was putting myself in the novel, if that makes any sense at all. But I always tell people, I said, you know, I feel that Garrett, he's always the same person in a group of crazy people. And I said, I always felt that way. And I said, I know people are pointing at me and saying I'm the crazy one. And we all think we're the same one. But to me, that was a fun aspect for Garrett to be able to write that and then put some of me into him. And I do that with a lot of the characters, even Asadi's character, probably more than anyone, because although he's from Afghanistan, I remember growing up, you know, on a ranch and riding horses and being with the cowboys, and I always wanted to prove myself, and I was always a little worried I was going to do something embarrassing, and so I get to throw myself into a lot of these different characters, which has been a lot of fun.
Well, you know, when I said Garrett is partly you, I wasn't actually thinking of you, you know, you as a person, you as a personality, so much as I was thinking about your career experience, because you know, he was in the CIA, right? And now he's
so Garrett, oddly enough, and everybody thinks he's CIA, he's really DEA. I know everybody thinks that because he's always working with the CIA, but his initial, he started with the DEA and he was over on a task force in Afghanistan, and he was under the purview of the CIA over there. And he messes up, and this is all the way back to Downranges, this is in the first couple of chapters, and basically ends up sort of under the CIA's purview, and he ends up operating and working for them, but technically he's a DEA guy. And here we are, and I just finished book four, and so he's still doing stuff with the CIA. So I don't know, sometimes things just sort of start a certain way and they end up a certain way, but people seem to be enjoying it and don't really care where he is as long as he's getting into a lot of trouble and trying to get himself out of it.
So he belonged to one of those three initial government agencies.
And then I didn't work directly. I didn't do work like the DEA, but when I worked with the military, did a lot of counter-narcotics stuff too. So I had that background and I could sort of throw that into Garrett's character, which of course was fun.
Well, as a border state, I mean, one of the things Texas has to think about is drug traffic and Mexican cartels. And another certainly is immigrants and who can hide, which is one of the problems in trying to deal with all that is that people can use, immigrant as cover. For filtering their way in. So although, you may not know this, and I'm not sure it's true, but when we were talking to Stephen Mack Jones a year or two ago, when he was here, his mysteries are based in Detroit. And he pointed out to us that actually the most porous and one of the largest immigrations into the United States sites is in fact Detroit.
Is that right?
Yeah, because of the lake, and because it's a border country that people can come down through Canada, and it's very difficult to patrol the lake. So, that's another place where our northern border doesn't get as much attention as our southern border when it comes to issues like immigration. But I think partly it's because we're already upset about the cartels going, bringing stuff in through the southern border much more than we think about them bringing stuff down from Canada, although they certainly do that too.
Yeah, so it's interesting you mention all that because book four, we're not even there yet, we're still in three, but I just finished up book four, and a lot of it starts down the border with the with trafficking and human trafficking, which is obviously a big topic these days. But I had the opportunity, of course, I as a writer, I'm doing my research, I know what I know. But I talk to people who live on the border. I talk to people on the political side, on the border issues. And I talk to a BORTAC agency. And these are the special operations border patrol guys. And man, some of the stories they tell me, you would not believe. It's wild and woolly. It's dangerous. The things the cartels do down there, it makes you get the impression that they own the border, not us. And not just the border, but pretty far into the border where they are basically not being challenged or they don't feel like they're challenged. And so it's kind of scary. And so again, we talk about, I could take these books overseas and sometimes I do, but we've got some scary stuff going on right here in our own country. And I think with the, as you mentioned, the cartels, nothing scarier than that.
Well, there's some really, hugely humanitarian issues involved in all of that too. And it's easy to get it all mixed up, but that's not what we're here to talk about. So moving on, what is the, because we are actually talking about book three, Ricochet, book four. Although here's the thing about authors, he wrote this book a while back. And so his head is actually more in book four right at this moment than it is in Ricochet, right?
I thought about that today. I was driving around. I went to I did a TV interview today and I was driving back and I was thinking, I don't really want to talk about book three. I want to talk about book four because, that's the one that I'm just right in. I'm in the heart of it. And book three, I'm like, oh, that's old news. But people don't think about that for authors. We wrote the thing a year ago and we've already moved on. And I know some of the guys talk about Mark Graney getting him on an interview. And he's like, now, what book is this again? Because he's so prolific. He's probably right 3 a year or something. But But no, it is a funny thing. But yeah, Ricochet. No, but Ricochet is fun. I think people are really going to enjoy it. And I really, I bring in, again, there's always an international angle to the Texas thing that I'm doing. And I never wanted it to be too far fetched. And so everything is grounded, you know, from Downrange to Firestorm to Ricochet. It's all grounded in reality. It's grounded in some sort of, there's international intrigue, but it's not just something that I've created. So book one, it has cartels. Book two, it has Wagner Group, the Russian mercenaries. Now, when I started writing about Wagner, nobody had ever even heard of them. And so now it's pretty much a household name. But when I started, you know, putting that in there, it wasn't based off Ukraine. It was based off what Wagner was doing in Africa. So I get into rare earth minerals and rare earth minerals mining in Texas and all that. And lo and behold, we ended up, right as the book came out, they said they were putting a rare earth minerals processing facility here in the Texas High Plains where I live, not far from where I had it in the book. So I'd written that a year before and then a year before. So hopefully book three, this is all about Pantex. And that's a lot of people are going to think I'm making this up. This is an actual nuclear weapons facility on the Texas High Plains outside of Amarillo. And as I describe in the book, it's when you drive by it, it's like a combination of a military base with a supermax prison. And you can imagine the level of security. These are literally the most destructive weapons on earth are right there in this location. And it's right there on the High Plains. It's creepy. It's weird. When you drive by, it's just pancake flat and you see these weird buildings out there. But this is where they work on our nuclear weapons. Our whole nuclear arsenal goes through there. And so we have all these former Navy SEALs, Green Berets, Rangers, Marines, you name it. These guys are out there protecting it. They're the ones literally riding shotgun when they're taking these places from military bases, because I mean, somebody's got to do it. And who do you want doing that but the best in the world? And so obviously that was a real opportunity for me to just sink my teeth into a fun thriller, some sort of a problem that would pop up legitimately here. And so I got to do a lot of background and put that all together. And I think it made for a fun story.
So you don't have to be overseas to write a spy story. Actually, there's a really interesting book by a guy named Bruce Burgos. You might have run across it. I'm going, Patrick, help me. I can't remember the title. But anyway, it is a spy story set in Eastern Nevada. And it is about the nuclear testing, you know, all of that in the 1950s. And, you know, Russians putting, you know, infiltrating people who then passed as Americans, the whole bit. So I thought it was a really fascinating book. You know, you say spy story in Eastern Nevada and people go, really? So, you know, same thing going on in the High Plains of Texas is really not that unusual.
No, I think not. And so we've got this going on. And even with, you know, going back to Firestorm, I'll write about the Russians. There was, believe it or not, whenever oil and gas was real hot and heavy and going, there was a lot of Russians that had moved in, and there was some weird, I worked on a couple of different things, not to any length, but some Russians had gotten involved here. And I heard stories about things that were going on that were a little heavy handed on their end, like as you would what might read in a book or see in a movie. And so obviously that carries forward. But no, I'm telling you, I think when you write something overseas, I think it's all fine and good. But I think for the reader who's sitting in America and thinking, well, that's great, that's happened in Afghanistan or Russia or wherever, I'm way far from that. But when it's rural America, you know, Nevada, Texas, or something like that, I think it brings it home for people. And I think it's fun as a reader to go, God, that could be happening two doors down.
Well, you know, we've been protected by two oceans for so long. And, you know, World War II broke that on the western side of the country. And really, there was a lot more that went on the East Coast than any of us probably ever realized when it was happening or has found out later. But we still, I think, have that feeling that, you know, it isn't happening here because of that. And the truth is that it is. I mean, so I like it that you are bringing some of this home so that we aren't too complacent. We have a, you know, we've always had a reluctance to get involved in foreign entanglements without realizing that increasingly today, that is a hopeless project. So, you know, there's division about support for the Ukraine. And you know, it's not that far away from us, and the consequences of what happens there are much more important to us than we think they are.
I think so. I think, and I understand the idea of wanting to stay out of those things, you know, just stay in our own business and not spend money and do all these things. But I think realistically, that time has passed, and we are entangled in some form or fashion, no matter how you want to look at it. So, realistically, we're involved, and as the, you know, largest military and biggest economy, we're involved no matter how you slice it. And so, how, you know, at what level you want to participate, you know, that's debatable, but we're in it. And so I think that's a fun thing for me as I write these books is to be able to bring that international, that sort of challenge, you know, back to the United States. And again, you know, I'm writing in a more rural part, but I show how these international things that you think don't affect you, they do affect you. And so I've had a lot of fun putting those into the books and trying to, you know, explain them in a way for people that they're, you know, that they would think, gosh, I never thought about that. But yeah, that affects our everyday lives.
So here's Garrett living on the high plains. He's had some wildfire to contend with. He's, you know, rebuilding his ranch, which was in pretty poor shape. So what is the instigating incident for this book? I love that phrase. The instigating incident is so much.
Yeah, you know, so this is fun. So for people who have read the series, they'll know that Garrett, the poor guy, all he wants to do is go home. He's, you know, rekindle the relationship with this high school crush, and he's got an adopted son at this point, and so he just wants to have a normal life to get back to his ranch. And he's done a pretty good job of this. The book starts with him sort of owing the CIA some favors, and he pays off these favors, and the book sort of begins in that form. So now he's just ready to live a normal life, but the problem is, as I say before, that puts me out of a job. So poor Garrett is always going to have some sort of calamity that will befall him. And in this particular case, he's just doing a favor for someone. Someone lets him know, a mutual friend says, hey, there's this guy that came to me with this problem. He works at a nuclear weapons facility. Sounds like he's being blackmailed. He needs to get in touch with somebody fast. He's in trouble. We may all be in trouble. So Garrett says, hey, no problem. I've got the right people that I can put you in touch with. Not me. I'm not that person, but I can help you. And unfortunately, things just sort of spiral out of control before Garrett can really hand off the baton to the people that can help. Things sort of spiral out of control, and Garrett is right smack dab in the middle of it. And so what ends up happening is, because of I was talking about nuclear weapons and those things, there's no turning a blind eye, and there's no saying like that's someone else's problem. When a nuclear weapon is, you know, on the loose in your backyard, then it's a problem for everyone. And so Garrett gets involved in that way, and that's how it all starts off.
So I suppose high action is sort of expected of a book that's taking place on the Texas plains. Landscape has so much to do with how things develop, and, you know, where you are is tremendous high visibility. It's not really, you know, people are not sneaking around in dark alleys and stuff like that. So, you know, you have to adapt your action to the actual physicality of the place?
You absolutely have to do that. And in some ways it helps you, in some ways it hurts you. The way it helps me is that legitimately around here, there's not a lot of cell phone service. And so, you know, the cell phone kind of ruined things for a lot of writers like us, because people say, well, I would just pick up a cell phone and call someone, you know? And so legitimately here, I mean, there are places not far from where I live, where you get out and there's just no service. So there's a certain amount of remoteness. Yes, can you see as far as the eye can see? You can. But I end up adding in things. That's why I have a lot of things like helicopters. Again, legitimately, people have helicopters out here because everything is so far that's how a lot of times people from Amarillo will get out to their ranches. And so it's a very real thing that people use as a tool that I put into the book. But yeah, you kind of have to think a little outside the box, because no, it's not dark alleys, and no, it's not hotel rooms, liaisons, but it's in the middle of a pasture. And so I set a lot of scenes that oil wells and things like that, and you know, big pastures or barns or whatever. But I think it's fun. I think it's different. And I think it's fun for readers because it takes them out of what they're normally used to seeing and just sort of sets the stage in a whole different way.
So you have a hijacking in this book, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I do have a hijacking.
I love it. A train, you know, because Texas is so big, train transportation. I mean, after all, trains are what allowed us to, you know, settle the West. Yeah.
The train's a fun part for me because, so people always ask me, they say like, well, how do you write a book? Do you start with a story? Do you start with a character? I say, I always start with a concept. And I know that sounds funny, but I think there's certain concepts that are very cool. So while my series and Ricochet, like all the others, is a thriller, it's also a modern Western. So what I like to do is take old elements of the old West and put them in this modern context. And so when I started doing a research about Pantex, one of the coolest things, that's the nuclear weapons facility, one of the coolest things was I started reading about the White Train. And the White Train is this, I mean, it's like the old days. It's how they, from the 1950s to the 1980s, they moved nuclear weapons by train car. And it was painted white. It was like an armored rail car with machine gun turrets. You can go take a tour of these things, and I did, of course. And it's got these bunks, and they'd put these soldiers in there with their weapons, and they're looking out for, I mean, it was just like the old West, the old Butch Cassidy and Sundance, you know, when these guys would, or Jesse James, wherever, they'd take over these rail cars, and some of them were outfitted with these gun turrets. I mean, this was really existed. And so in my mind, I thought, what would this look like if the White Train was brought back? And so I did my research, and feasibly, I thought this might be brought back at some point because of all the problems with hauling them by semis. So I sort of build that in the story, and then build that into Ricochet, that the White Train is sort of returned, although nobody knows it's happening. It's all done sort of in hiding in plain sight. And so that's how the train thing came along. But so far, people that are reading it are loving it. They think it's really cool.
I don't think, you know, train robbery, who could resist that? Or
train heist, I mean, yeah, right.
Or you could go all the way back to Stagecoach, you know, which is like the quintessential Western, you know, whatever it is. Love that. And certainly when you've got as much space to cross as Texas, you know, it becomes a lot more feasible than like Monument Valley, which is where Stagecoach was filmed. So, right, you've got all kinds of great things in here for people to like. Why don't you go back and remind us about Garrett's love life? Because part of the books is there is a love story.
Yeah, so that's an important part of this. And you know, you might remember my first editor was David Heifel, a legend in the thriller business, who, of course, is retired, and loved David. And I remember when we first started this, he said, a lot of times, you know, we'll call this, he said, normally we call this a Garrett Cole thriller. And he said, we're going to call this a Garrett Cole novel, because there's so much more going on. It's got the thrilling, it's got the actions and bullets and bombs, but it's also got a love story. It's got a story about a father and son, two multi-layered. I mean, it's from Garrett and his dad, and Garrett to Asadi, the boy that he takes under his wing from Afghanistan. But Lacey, his love interest, she was really, I think I might've called her a high school flame. She was a high school crush. Like she kind of knew he existed, but not really. And he comes back into town, and she's divorced, and she's a mother of two, and working at a cafe. And so they just sort of rekindle things. And so things have been kind of steadily progressing. The problem is Garrett. He's always had these things that keep calling him away, and they want to get married, and they both love each other, but things sort of keep popping up that get in the way of their relationship. And so they're just trying to work through this. And in Ricochet, they continue to try to work through this. And so Lacey, without giving away too much for people that read it, she tells him that she wants to be a part of his life. If this is going to work, she sort of recognizes he is who he is. If this is going to work, then she wants to be involved. And so he gets her involved to a lot of interesting dynamics in the book. And so I'll leave it at that, because I know people like to come in fresh, but Lacey's a major character and in a great part of the Garrett Cole story.
Right. And when you have kids, you know, kids can enrich the family thing, but they can also potentially be hostages to whatever's going on, you know. So there's always that question about, if you have children, how much can you put yourself in danger? Because then it leaves your kids in danger. It was a big argument in the women's sleuth movement back in the 1990s, when all of a sudden there was this whole thing about women as private investigators and women doing all this dangerous stuff. And the argument was that they couldn't have children because readers would really be averse to, you know, Kinsey Millhone as a mom, you know, out there waiting to be shot or doing whatever it is. So there's a responsibility, you know, to children if you're a parent about how much danger you can put yourself in.
There is, and I build that into the story because especially with Lacey, now Garrett does too, but you know, before he had no dependents, he was just out there on his own, and that was fine. If he died, he died. He didn't want to, but if it was done in the line of duty, then so be it. With Lacey, that's the same thing. She's got two kids to think of, and so there's a part of her that that wants to be involved in his world, but then there's a part of her that recognizes, look, I'm a mother. I don't have the luxury of wanting to be involved. I've got these kids to look out for, but sometimes things just happen. And and again, without giving away too much in the book, sometimes you accidentally end up in peril.
Well, you do. I mean, it's different also if you're a single parent. You know, if you can't offload it on, you know, the other parent. There are a number of police novels that where that kind of thing goes on. There's a very good British one that I recently read in which the woman is the officer, and her husband and her children are constantly taking a back seat because being a cop is like an addiction, at least for people writing about it. Maybe in real life, they just go home. You know, who knows? But if you're on the homicide unit, apparently, you know, it's all hours, everybody out all the time. And so what happens to the kids and the dad? But then there is a dad. So, you know, there's backup in case something happens. So, you know, every writer has to make decisions about the personal dynamics, the family structure, if any, you know, the personal relationships and what's going to work for what it is that you want to write about and what it is you want to say.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's one thing I've said before is that I really like to write those things into the stories because, I like to write things that are relevant for everyone because hopefully it's not relevant, you know, cartel sicarios trying to kill you or Russian mercenaries coming after you or whatever. I hope that's not part of people's everyday lives. But having children and dealing with whether no matter what kind of job you do, there's always these pros and cons of how much time you're at work and how much your time you're with kids or. There's always family drama. No matter what family is, there's going to be some sort of drama going on at some point. And so I write that in the story. And then the whole running into an old high school crush or whatever it is, I like writing those things into the story because I think people, they're relatable, they're relevant, they're things that people can hold on to. And then, so again, they might not be like Garrett, might not be battling it out with an assassin or something, but they can deal with having a cantankerous old dad or a son that they're worried about or a girl that they're in love with or whatever it is. I think people can relate to it. And so I really enjoy putting those kind of things in the books.
So here we are with a modern Western spy story, or at least a high action, however you want to look at it. Patrick, come back and see if you have any questions or anybody in the audience has questions.
All right. Let's see here. Okay. Right. Well, I think you've addressed this a little bit already, but Russ says, I'm a big fan of Taylor and Garrett Cole. Excited to read my copy from the pen. All right. Thanks, Russ. At some point, Taylor, do you see Garrett going away on assignment outside of Texas to confront events taking place in Texas?
So he might have stumbled on book five. I just finished up four and I'm outlining five and six. And so book five, it might take a little bit of an outside adventure, maybe not too far, but I have some plans for that. Book four is going to take someone else outside of the country, and I won't get into that. But for people that follow the series, they probably know. I know exactly where it's going. I know why they would be outside of the country, but I won't give it away. Book four, I just finished it, and again, I'm excited about it. I think it's the most fun. The most fun I've had writing any has been book four, And but book five and six are going to be great. So for people that follow the series, if you like the characters and you like all the intrigue and the storyline, it's just going to keep going. It's going to get better and crazier and wilder and scarier but it's just going to keep going. So yeah, the answer is yes, I do have those plans.
Let's see. Yeah, there are a couple of questions that are just about, you know, basically the craft of writing. And how do you get the words out every day? Do you have are you a morning writer? Are you an evening writer? Things like that.
So it's funny, I just answered some questions on that today for another interview. And my answer was this: my process changes all the time. And I didn't think it would. But for this last book, for this book four, I never did the word count thing. You know, some people do a certain word count. So I started doing 1,500 words a day. And I think I got that from Mark Graney. I think I heard him in an interview say that. And I thought, okay, well, I'll give it a try. And I did that, and I love it. I love that 1,500 words a day because it. I don't have it as much as when I started, but I have that horrific writer's guilt. If I'm not writing, I feel like I should be writing or should be doing something or editing. But when I hit that word count, I go, because I know I can do the math. I can figure out how much I need to get to the, you know, my deadline and what I need to do in terms of research. It's not a perfect strategy, but it's pretty good. But when I hit that 1,500 words, I think you've done it for the day. You know, you've got a chapter in or whatever. And that's, you can check that box. But before, I never felt like I'd done enough. And so I think in terms of just the process, that's one of the newer things that I've done. Another strange one, and I wrote that today, is that I used to write chapter by chapter just as someone would read in the book. So I would just want, if this person's point of view, then I change and I change and I change and I change. And that sounds horrible now that I look back. I don't know why I did that. And now I started sticking with a storyline for parts. I always have four parts in a novel. So for part one, part two, you know, part one, I'll write a storyline, a point of view, and I'll continue on for each, and then I'll stop and edit. So I don't really know why, but it seems to have made life better for me. And I know everybody's got their different strategy, but that is something that has taken me four books to figure out, or really more than four books, you know, if you count the books that never went anywhere.
Well, I don't know why it shouldn't evolve. I mean, you know, creative people are always evolving. Painters, sculptors, you know, what's different?
Yeah, and I called, I can't remember why. Sometimes I call Don Bentley. He's my go-to mentor for everything. And so I think I told Don, and Don said, yeah, I change all the time. And he said, Nick Petrie had told him, you're going to change all the time. And so I felt okay about it. For some reason, having these guys tell me it's okay. But at first I felt weird. I thought, well, I had this method. Why would I depart from the method? But I think it's okay. I think it's okay. Yeah, like I said, I think it's okay to be innovative and try something new and see what works. And if it doesn't work, you go back to the old thing. But I've really liked what I've been doing. But, you know, by book five, I may do something totally different. I'll write it backwards or something. I don't know.
Why not? Well, we're used to eccentric writing processes here at the Poison Pens.
So I bet you've heard everything at this point. Yeah, you probably heard everything at this point.
We have. But you know what? It's fine. I mean, it's a creative act. And what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another. But sometimes you do get tips from people that say, you know, try this and it can help your own process. And I don't know. It seems to me it ought to evolve, but oftentimes it doesn't. Many times, you know, I think some writers are really superstitious, and whatever worked for them the first time, they just keep doing it. But we're all different, right?
We're all different. So now I think everybody's just got to find their own thing. The one thing I will say that's kind of interesting, people that aren't writers a lot of times will ask me how do you write a book? How do you do it? And I will say that's the only part of me. I'm not very artsy, but that's where I get a little bit artsy. I say there is a magic that happens on the page and I can't explain it because I don't know. I said, because people say, well, like, do you outline what you're going to? I was like, I have a rough outline. I kind of know where the story's going to go, but I'll just put, you know, do chapter. And then I'll be like, huh, this is going to be Garrett and Mario is the Contreras, the former SEAL. I was like, they're going to say something to each other. What's it going to be? And I just, you know, I just have a scenario that, but I have no idea how it's going to play out, but it plays out on the page. And I don't know till it gets there. It's a magic that happens and your fingers just start going.
Is there a part of the process?
I have to write. Sorry, Patrick, what?
I was going to say, is there a part of the process that you like better? Do you like coming up with just the raw first draft, getting it out there? Or do you like shaping it and editing and that process?
No, I hate that. I hate that part. I wish I would be great. I love doing the storytelling. I love the raw, the draft. I love the writing. I guess I shouldn't say I hate the editing. I hate the editing at the very end. I think there's a point to where, and I remember Steve Barry hearing him say this, to where he literally can't read a sentence anymore. And I usually get to that point where I just hate it. You know, I just have read it and I've gone over it so many times that I just hate it. And so there is a part of me, I'd love to do the rough draft and then just hand it over to someone else and be like, okay, I'm on to the next thing. You make this look pretty. But that's the harder part for me. I like telling the story. I like jumping in and just going nuts with that. And then the editing part, the edit after it gets better, but that first edit is pretty horrible, I think. And that's probably true for most writers, I think, because most people say they look at their first draft and like, this is garbage. I thought it was so good and it's just terrible. But I think every writer looks at it and go, I felt so brilliant in the moment. And then you don't feel very brilliant when you see your first draft, but it gets better.
Do you have any non-Garrett ideas for novels?
I do. If somebody ever wanted a standalone, I write them down. You know, sometimes something will hit me and I have an idea. I've got before I started doing this, when I wrote for fun, I wrote young adult. And so I've got a young adult thing that I'd love to go back to. I've got a historical fiction idea that I'd love to do. And then there's one kind of more of a, my books are fun. They're espionage, but they're fun, like Bourne or any of those other ones. But there's one that's a more serious, kind of like a David McCloskey Damascus Station idea that I have of something that I actually worked on at the CIA. And of course, if I ever did it, I'd want to go back to them and say like, hey, I'd like to do this in a safe way. Like, you know, like we're not revealing anything, but I'd like to do it right and interview the right people and really tell the story in a maybe slightly more literary way. So I've got an idea for that. But, you know, as long as they want to keep the series going, I'll keep doing that. But no, I've got other ideas if anybody ever wanted to do it.
Do you know Kathleen Kent by chance?
What do I know?
Kathleen Kent?
I don't know.
Kathleen, yeah, because she's also, I'm not sure if she's from Texas, but, you know, has written a Texas series, but also has a, an intelligence background. I thought you might have.
That name sounds really familiar, but I don't know her personally, but I'd like to, if we both have that background in Texas. So I'll look her up whenever we get off.
She wrote a Texas historical too that you might like as well.
Okay. No, I'll check that out. Patrick, no, that name, now that you said it, it rings a bell.
Yeah, Patrick can email you selected readings. That's one of the things we have.
Patrick, we've kind of gone off on our tangent of nonfiction. We're supposed to be talking fiction here at the Poison Pit.
We're supposed to be just talking about whatever we want. Every publicist that writes to me anxiously and say, you know, what is the runner show? I say sign on 5 minutes early and then we just make it up. And that's true. It really is true because, you know, there shouldn't be a formula to doing this. It should be whatever feels like it's fun to talk about at the moment. So thank you very much for popping on. Here we have our book, Ricochet. We have autographed copies. I'm hoping Taylor will come and see us next time. He did come and see us to host his idol Nelson DeMille last year, which was wonderful. And yeah. I'm hoping maybe you'll just come and see us on your own at book four, since you love it so much.
If I've got an invitation, I'll be there, Barbara.
Well, we'll do it. Yeah, maybe we'll have a Texas rally, or maybe since Don Bentley is a perpetual host at the Poison Pen, maybe we'll just get you and Don. Maybe we'll get Don to move here.
I think Don at least needs an apartment over in Scottsdale. That's what I think.
He should. I mean, we may have to work that out because he's a brilliant interviewer. He really is great, but he's so well connected now with, you know, everybody. And anyway, we'll work something out. Thank you all very much for joining us. Enjoy your book. Don't forget to order Ricochet. And bye. Thank you very much again.
Good night.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.